Welcome to the Private Practice Made Perfect podcast with me, Kathy Love. I'm a business coach who helps allied health professionals run powerful and profitable businesses in the disability sector. Join me for cutting-edge interviews with leaders in the allied health and business fields, along with plenty of practical content that you can use to make your business practice perfect. Hello, everybody. It's Kathy Love here, and my guest today is Sarah Munn, whose last words before I hit record were, "I can talk for hours." So maybe we're here for the rest of the afternoon. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you. Hi, Kathy.
Now, you do therapy differently, but we'll get to that. Tell us about barefoot therapists, who you are, where you are.
So barefoot therapists used to be barefoot OT when it was just me. Following in those footsteps of the barefoot doctor, the barefoot investor, those down-to-earth, grassrootsy, we can take our shoes off if we like, we don't need to be in, you know, corporate suits kind of feel. And so that's how I started out when I was on my own. And initially I'd done paediatrics since I qualified in 96. So I did a lot of work in England and in London, and then management roles over here when I moved here. And then I had my two children, and my eldest son I had at 40, and he's got Down syndrome. So I then found myself on the other side of the services, and that was really quite difficult for me. Mm. Kind of going, yeah, you don't know what you're talking about.
And that was quite difficult. He was born here in Australia?
He was born here, yeah. He was born in Australia, yeah. Yeah, so, I moved over here, met a very nice Aussie bloke and never went back, really. That then, I ended up with two children and toddlers, and difficult toddlers at that, and I just felt I needed to get out of the house. National registration had come in Australia, and because I trained in England, there were hoops to jump through, and I thought, and I wasn't really ready to go back to work either. But I thought, if I don't do something soon, I will be too distant from my experience to be registered. So I got myself going again, and realised that I had all these skills, and that there were other kids around that were in need of those, you know, paediatric therapy skills. Spoke to a few people. I think that was the first time we met. Just finding out who'd got subcontracting work, what was going on, who was around, and in the end, just picked up a couple of clients. And the phone rang and rang and rang and rang.
And should we tell everyone that we live in the best place in Australia on the Mornington Peninsula, or will we just tell them that it's not so good and they don't need to visit?
They can come as long as they want to work a barefoot.
Yeah, true. Very true. Oh, it's perfect employment situation.
It is. It is. And look, it is. It's wonderful down here. And I think because I am where I am has meant that I have been able to take the practice in a different direction, which became barefoot therapists once we were employing not only OTs but speakers. And, you know, as your team grows, then a barefoot OT wasn't appropriate. So we changed to barefoot therapists. And as you know, some of our therapists are four-legged, so we have a barefoot therapists.
They are. So you had your first beautiful boy, and then number two came along, and you're getting back into work and the phone's ringing. What was the time frame really between the solopreneur and what you've got now? Because you need to tell us about what you've got now as well.
So the boys, we ran away from home basically with the boys in a caravan and headed off for 18 months around Australia. We left with a 1 and a 2-year-old, came back with a 2 and a 3-year-old, who at that point we didn't realise both of them also had autism and ADHD and were running around, and I really was finding it hard to do it on my own. One heading for the road, one heading for the beach and the water. And so Luke and I just said, let's go, let's do it together. We went off for 18 months, got back, and then that was at the point where I thought, okay, I need to get my grown-up shoes on, get back into work. And so I probably spent about a year. I'd had a call from a school to say, would you do 4 hours a week with us? Our OT's just retired. They'd had an OT for 20 years.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Amazing. So I said, yeah, sure, I'll step into those shoes. And then what happened was, as my younger child was recommended to do another year of kinder, I'd kind of got 3 days a week kinder hours, so I was kind of 9 till 3, you know, and they did daycare kind of thing. But then he needed to repeat kinder, and I wanted him to go to a nice little program around the corner, which did silly hours, you know, 9:30 to 11:30. And I was like, I can't work that time. So luckily I found
something entrepreneur friendly.
No, it really wasn't. But it was what I needed to do. My other boy had started at prep, so I was like, I need to focus on this number two child's all over the place too. And so I found another woman actually who was in a similar situation, had done paediatric OT, was also had a one preschooler left at home, and she said, I'll take your school day. So I said, okay, I didn't want to lose that contract. Mm. So she took a little bit. She's still with me. That was back in 2013, I think. And she's still with me. She now does 4 days a week and leads up our outdoor programs. So we went from, I found another nice girl who I knew who wanted a couple of days a week, and then I took on her full time. And then after I got, I think, my first three staff, I'd kind of done the pool of people that I knew.
Yeah.
Had to start advertising. So then, yeah, we had we advertised, you know, one position at a time, really. And yeah. Now we've got 21 staff altogether now. So it there would always be a period of time in between where I would feel like I've kind of got a caseload there, but not really. You know, where you think you've got 30, 40 kids on the waiting list, so they'll probably form a full-time caseload, but then they don't because they've gone elsewhere or they've done other things, or, you know, and so then
the movable feast.
Movable feast. But for a long time, I didn't really have to do marketing. I set up a couple of years ago a fairly good Facebook page, which was more about, I suppose, developing confidence. We didn't really need people to ring. You know, we still have a waiting list, even with all our staff, as everyone does now with NDIS. But it was really more about, yes, you've made the right decision. Yes, we're still having fun with the kids. Yes, it's still working, you know, and really trying to communicate with our community, but not just in a, you know, we want your business kind of way, but more in a let's all be part of the same community kind of way.
Yeah. Your personal voice is very clear on your Facebook page, which is, I guess, a point of difference with you as a mum and a provider. It's noticeably different from many other businessy type pages.
I think so, and I've eased back from that. When I first started, there was a fair amount of splurge from me.
I felt as though I was holidaying with you at times.
I know, and it was like if my kids had food up the walls, you know, and I think, oh, and I talk to friends and say, am I sharing too much? You know, is this too much? And then it reached a natural stage for me as my children got older where it wasn't actually appropriate to be talking about the things they were struggling with in that way. But a lot of people, clients and friends, would say, we just wait for your post because you describe what we're going through.
Called it as it was.
Absolutely. And they're like, we can't believe you with everything you know. You still shout at your children. It's like, I do, yeah. I'm a mum and I lost it on that day, and that's okay because, you know, occasionally you're not perfect. But as time's gone on and my boys have got older, and certainly my second son, you know, he does have autism. He's on the spectrum, but he's high functioning, very sociable. He's out there, you know, and I certainly don't think it's appropriate now to be telling his story other than he's a fabulous cricketer and look at the award he won and, you know, normal mummy things. Mm-hmm. But I really don't talk much about any of the, you know.
the privacy issues become different as well as they get older, or at some point when you decide.
It does.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm only prepared to discuss what he is prepared to discuss and make public. Yeah. And, you know, and he's quite cool with being on the spectrum. You know, he's got a lot of friends who are. That's not a big thing anymore, which is great.
Yeah.
But really, apart from that, you know, it does become that line of whose story is it to tell?
Correct. And so yeah.
I can only tell my story, and I need to do that with dignity, respect, and privacy. Mm. You know, for my husband too, you know, that unless I've checked it out, it's not their story, isn't my story.
No. So how have those beautiful little big boys inspired what you do now?
Oh, hugely, hugely. And in two ways. One, how much therapy is beneficial. And I genuinely can see things that my eldest boy can do, which I genuinely don't think. He's got a catalogue of, you know, he's got one of those long lists of diagnoses. And I really don't think he would have been doing it had he not had a keen eye noticing in those early intervention years. And yet my younger one is actually doing pretty well, thanks. And do you know what? We say to the NDIS, no, we don't need anything.
Yeah.
Because you don't, I kind of realise you can over-therapy people. And so it's one of the things in our culture at Barefoot I try to do with my staff is, you know, if they're done, they're done. You know, we don't need to over-service. Review your goals. You can set new ones, but any child can be needing to set goals, and any child can be not very good at something. Does it mean they need therapy when you've got a waiting list? And then that can be difficult because some parents are like, oh, we want to do everything we can. We're so worried, you know. And those ODD, ADHD, anxiety, autism, those kids, and everyone's like, but they're going to end up on ice. They're going to end up in prison and everyone's petrified. So no.
More doesn't mean more outcomes or more.
No.
I worked with a wonderful client for a long time, and he made the most progress across the board developmentally when he was away on holidays with his family in Bali every year.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we used to sort of joke, I knew them really well, we used to say, oh, I think it's time for a couple of weeks in Bali, just come back later.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know what, I think what that has inspired is me in me is that those kids don't really want to go and sit in a room with a therapist. And yet my boys and, you know, a lot of our clients, they are very happy to join in with a group that's a building group run by an OT, and my husband does that. He's a carpenter by trade. And to do some of the outdoor groups that we do. And suddenly that's quite an exciting thought. So parents that have been saying, we really want you to see a psychologist, or we think you should see an OT, and the kids are old enough and bright enough to go, stuff you, I don't want to. I'm not coming. I'll slam the door. What can you do?
So paint the picture about Barefoot therapists now.
So now there's we've got 9 OTs, 3 speeches. We've got a provisional psychologist and a dietitian that comes in to do our eating clinics with us. And we've got 4 admin staff and an equine facilitated learning practitioner and 3 therapy assistants that help us with our groups.
And we're not going to find you in the shopping centre or on the side of the main road, are we?
No. Our clinic is based at an equestrian centre. So we're surrounded by horses and nature, and our building group is making some planter boxes now for our horticulture group that we want to run. We've got a little studio downstairs which has a bed that the kids can learn to make and a washing machine so they can learn to do those things. We do a bike riding group on the property, which has got, I mean, it's a beautiful property. It's a big, you know, a beautiful big place with, you know, roads that kind of go right through it. So we're very, very fortunate that we got those facilities and they're very generous there to let us, you know, take up a lot of that space. And we do have 5 horses there now. I started the horse therapy at home with my couple of horses I had out the back paddock, and it grew and grew and grew. So now one of our speech pathologists is also a very experienced horsewoman, and a provisional psychologist is a very experienced horsewoman as well. She is also qualified teacher, and she used to run a riding school, and she's terrific. So we've got these terrific people that know how to handle horses and also provide the therapy to the families at the same time. So that has been awesome to have that point of difference. And I think because of that, that's what's ended up going, hang on, they actually just want to come and hang out on the farm. Some of the kids aren't even that bothered about the horses, but they want to push the wheelbarrow around and they want to do jobs.
Dig holes,
help out, climb the tree. You know, and we'll be the one place, we're probably the only equine facility where if people say, can they climb the fences? Absolutely, let's see how they do it. Mm. I want to know how they climb a fence. I want to look at that motor planning. You know, there's so much to be done out there.
So, pardon me. there is way more to it than signing the lease on a stunning property snuggled in the gorgeous green hills amidst the cherry and strawberry farms. And there's way more to it than having lovely, friendly horses. What has been the business model behind this, the legals and the workplace health and safety and insurance? Surely that was fun.
Yeah, that was really difficult. My first feeling when I had my ponies out the back was, and I hadn't had horses all my adult life. I trained horses with my mum when I was a kid, and then in my adult life didn't, and then got back into them. And my first feeling really was, I'm seeing kids in my private practice that really I'd like them to get down, give the pony a carrot, tie it up, give it a brush, maybe walk it round, maybe put a few poles out to walk it over. And I thought that would be great to do, but I know I won't be insured to do that.
Yeah.
It's not part of my undergraduate training, you know. I haven't done postgraduate training in it. There isn't any. So I kind of knew that it wasn't that simple. So at that point I went and did equine facilitated learning training, and that basically allowed me to get insurance to provide EFL, but that's not therapy. So then I still had to satisfy myself that I was doing EFL and satisfying their insurance, but equally that I was still within my
scope of OT, your OT-ness.
That's right, my scope of practice. And look, I've spoken to OT Australia about this right from the start. I said, this is what I'm doing. What do you think? Can we make it extended scope practice? What do we need to do that? Because hippotherapy is where kids get on and ride. So there is a kind of horse intervention that we can train in. So I wanted to do that for more what I do, more of the groundwork, more of the psychosocial, process and motor kind of skills. And so we're still working on that. And looking at the literature around the world and seeing what the evidence is. And there's just not that many people like me doing it. Most of the horse therapy is actually run by people who aren't therapists. So it's confusing for people. And where was I?
We were talking about the safety.
Yeah.
Safety for you and safety for the kids and carers.
Yeah, yeah. So I did. I took a lot of advice from OT Australia about how I could do it, and from the insurers about what I needed in place and how many clients I could see for that level of insurance and, you know, all that kind of thing. And, you know, I was very careful what kind of training I did to allow me to do what I wanted to do. I'd been to places like Riding the Disabled or Riding Develops Abilities, as RDA is now called, and they have a whole different set of skills and a whole different set of insurance, and they're not really allowed to get the kids off and, you know, get them running around with them and work with them off the line and that kind of thing. So that wouldn't have been the right road for me to go to.
Yeah. Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah. And it's a huge world, and there's so many different approaches. It's almost like everyone's set up their own thing. But it's unregulated. It's not a regulated profession, which scares me silly. So we've got to the point with OT Australia now where we're working at the moment on me being able to train therapists that want to use their own horses. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say use. We don't actually say use. We say include.
Include,
yeah. We don't use the horses.
They just happen to be there in a vehicle for the awesomeness.
Yeah. So now that's where we're at with actually trying to establish some kind of training and continue working towards, can this be extended scope practice, or what is the scope of the OT and where does that finish and end, and where do you maybe need someone else around to hold the horse or not, or depending on your skills. Because obviously there's lots of people that are great horse people, they're not necessarily therapists. There's lots of fabulous therapists that have had a horse, but it's a very different thing trying to work on a horse's process, a child's process. Remember your therapeutic goals. Remember your kindness to your animals when they want to pull them around the paddock. There's a lot to do. It's the hardest work I have ever done.
Because, is it really?
Yes. To do it properly and to do it well. I have a horse's emotions and feelings and behaviours to think about. And my horses, they're not dull. They're not riding school horses. Mm. They can take fright. They can not want to go over something. And that's the whole point, that the child learns
such is life.
Playing a horse. That's right.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's the hardest, most, I wouldn't recommend it to therapists that haven't done much therapy, and I wouldn't recommend it to therapists that haven't done much groundwork and horsemanship either, because it's hard work.
Yeah.
And you can't make mistakes. Yeah.
Yeah. So business is kind of growing really, really well, and somewhat organically and somewhat intentionally. How have you built in the business chocks under all the services that have just been mushrooming up?
Usually it's felt like a galloping racehorse and I've been dragged along behind.
Well, I'm just being diplomatic, making it perhaps sound marginally better than it is. I don't know.
No, I've pretty much got dragged along going, I need some structure.
Where's the cash?
Yeah, where's the cash in the horse feed?
Yes. Yes, you have a very expensive therapeutic vehicle there too, which is interesting. Anyway, back to the how did the business stuff develop?
So, look, I mean, I was always behind. I was always behind. But that really didn't scare me. I'm a very intuitive person. I've even had a business coach who's worked with me through meditation. I'm very happy to do those kind of left of center things. So I was always kind of, I set out my stall in the early days to say, I'm not doing this for a big profit. If I can make a living at it, fabulous. But I'm not doing it for a big profit. I'm doing it because I was born to do it.
Mm.
I know that sounds iffy, but I just kind of was. And then when the horse stuff melded into it as well, it was like, no, this is what I'm meant to be doing. Even though at times it was hard work and I'd tear my hair out and I wouldn't have enough money to make ends meet, I kind of was clear from the beginning that the kind of therapy I wanted to do, the kind of quality I wanted, was important. And that was about, truly about families. So I made the building blocks as I went. I would kind of go, okay, I've got too many clients now to be keeping handwritten notes. I need a practice management system.
Which one did you go with?
Core Plus.
Okay.
Yeah, which I've had for a long time now. But, you know, when you get to the point where you go, I've got too much on to do my own invoicing. I now need a bookkeeper or an assistant. Mm. And I've got too many clients to do myself. So you get one who's happy to work off your kitchen table, and then it's like, well, actually I need rooms. I don't want all of this stuff in my home and my client, my staff coming into my kitchen. I mean, everybody still does, but we now, so then I got some rooms, and that meant I needed to go, okay, well, what do my contracts really look like? You know, where's my, and I got Employsure on board.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. I found fabulous. They helped me when I was kind of going, these contracts are probably good enough and they're all nice people and nothing bad is going to ever happen. But in honesty, being serious about it.
Just tighten them up a little.
They didn't protect me and they didn't protect them. And I always wanted to be a good employer. I always wanted to be flexible and fair. But that became difficult because, oh, hang on, you're on a permanent contract, which means I can't say 1 week you do 30 hours, next week just do 20 if you want. I was like, oh, that looks something different. That's casual. You know, so I really had to get my head around what all the different contracts looked like, what people really wanted. And for a while I had a mixture and that came back to bite me really. I was so flexible. But then staff would talk to each other and the permanents would be saying, oh, you get more an hour, and the ones that got more an hour were
saying, water cooler conversation.
Yeah. And that was
really tricky, being too flexible.
Yeah, it can be. And I think as well, you know, it didn't make the team as cohesive as I wanted it, because there was always, and people didn't understand. Like, people would say to me, oh, so-and-so gets so much an hour. It's like, but that's nothing to do with it. You don't know what, you know, what other arrangements they've got around their, you know, their workplace.
The leader emerges.
Yeah. So now pretty much I've got a couple of people that are on casual contracts, because, like, for example, my administration team want to be casual because they do increase and decrease, and then they might not want to do the holidays, but then they might want to earn a bit extra. So that they have truly casual positions and they like that. But my therapist now, apart from some that really only do 4 or 5 maybe horse sessions a week, so it's not so many, you know, they might be on casual, but the bulk, the majority of us are permanent contracts with all the bells and whistles, because It feels fair. It feels even. You can follow some kind of progression in your salaries. Mm. There's none of this in the tea room. Well, what are you on? And do you get your petrol paid or not? And, you know, everyone's got the same, you know.
I mean, status yeah. as such. Yeah. Yeah. So what does your week look like? Because a team of 21 is significant, and you've got the kiddos and you've got your stuff and family stuff, and someone's got to pay the bills and, or yeah, kind of support clients as well. How do you kind of divide your week up to get enough of everything done?
I employed my husband. That was a good move.
Yeah, it was. You were saying that.
Yeah. So that made a difference to us because he was a chippy, and he had his own building company for a while, and which was, you know, just becoming successful. And he went, I can't do it. We can't run two businesses and have two kids, and one of them has a lot of appointments. We can't do this. And so it was his call, really. He said, I'm going to sell out to my partner my construction business, and just as it was about to start paying some money back.
Yay. It's all about so timing.
And I was like, you know what, mate, if that's what you need to do, you go for it, because you've got one life. And if you're stressed and you're not enjoying it, do it. You don't have to.
Come over to this side of the fence and enjoy this flavour of crazy.
Well, I tried to recruit him then, and he didn't. He went and he subcontracted as a chippy for another couple of years. And all the way through I'm going, you're good with the horses, you're good with the kids, you know, you could do some this, you could run some building groups for me. And he needed to do that in his own time. Mm-hmm, and he did, and so middle of last year, in fact the start of winter, he came home one night after being on a cliff edge building a brand new, you know, however multi-million dollar home, and he got back. He said, I don't want to do it anymore, I'm too cold. He said, I'm cold. I said, oh, I've got a receptionist that's leaving. Why don't you go
in a heated office with red hill views.
Yeah. So he took over the nice warm office, and that was really good. So what he did was he had a dig around in the business, because he's a smart guy. He'd done project management. He'd run a business. He had a dig around and said, okay, there's a couple of things in here you need to focus on. And I was like, okay, who's the best person to do that? And we worked that out. And that helped me to then go, you know what? He used to go to work, you know, he'd be up and out 5:30 in the morning. And I said, you know what, I've done packed lunches and getting two kids together with visual schedules and everything else that you need to get, you know. Kids out the door. And I said, you know what, I would like a break from that. So he took that on. And so that meant that I could breathe a bit in the mornings, I could get on my yoga mat without too many interruptions, and I could kind of start to build in some well-being for myself. So pretty much now, we do things like make sure all the horses have hay and that kind of thing in the mornings, and get the kids to school, and one of us will go into work usually for 9, or I'll work from home a bit too so I can just get my head down and get on with it. Mm-hmm. Mondays and Fridays I tend to try and keep appointment free. Mm-hmm. So I won't see clients and I don't book meetings.
So you're still working as an OT? You still have clinical appointments?
Not many this year, because I want to spend some time focusing on the business. And I've got a few other things I want to do, developing the equine therapy further. So it won't happen if I don't put the time in. So, and now I've got so many great staff, I don't feel so bad saying to my clients, you know what, it would actually be time for you to work with someone else. And, you know, I occasionally would do, I had one girl that would see me at 7:30 in the morning at home. And I said, you know, the horses have gone. They've gone to our main clinic. I don't have horses I can work with such a little kid at home anymore at 7:30. And I was like, I don't want to go there for 7:30. So that kind of gave me the option to really claw some stuff back. And so now I have more meetings, you know, there's more supervision, more PD, more liaison with my own staff to make sure they're supported and know what they're doing. But generally I have 3 days when I'm happy to have meetings and clients, mm-hmm. and then 2 days which are my, you know, more flexible, like today is a Monday.
Your business bookends.
Yeah.
Because it takes a ton of time and energy to run a business of your size and of your growth trajectory? You know, you've got 21 folks, you've got horses, you've got hundreds of customers, you've got marketing and payroll, and there's just so many bits and pieces to it that it takes time. And so often I talk to business owners who have two, if not three, full-time jobs. They're full-time at home, full-time clinician, full-time business owner, and that would just make you tired and a bit grumpy, I reckon.
Yeah, look, I think so. I mean, I've got a really good team. I've got a good practice manager. But, again, she's not full-time. But, you see, both of us, people would probably look at our calendar and say, they're not full-time. But we will be the ones talking on the phone in an evening. One of us will get a call to say someone's not coming in because the kids are sick. So we're actually always on call. So I think even if I only had 3 hours in my weekly schedule that anyone else could see, still full-time.
Yeah.
You know, and I still do hands-on things. I still pay the staff. I want to know what's going out. You know, so I've got a few things that I still do that are very hands-on. But between my practice manager and I, we divvy things up fairly well. And I've become much better at going, you know, everything's going to be okay. I've had my times when I've gone down in a ditch and gone, I don't think I want to do this anymore. You know, it's too hard and I don't think I want to do it and it's affecting my well-being. But I've always kind of pulled out as soon as someone starts saying, yes, I know, well, you could sell it, or, you know, it's your baby and you started this from the beginning. I start going, yes, I did.
I just need a good sleep.
Yes, and what else would I do? So I've had a couple of times through, I suppose I started into end of 2012, I was getting it together. And I suppose I've had a couple of times since then when I've really done a big review of myself. I'm going, is this what I need at the moment? Is this right for my life, for my family? And both times I've come out much stronger saying, yes, I just need to take it to the next level.
Yep.
You know,
and that's step where away. I suppose, to step yeah. back for a week or a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Take the foot off, step back.
Step back, and that's sometimes where I've then put in those blocks underneath that when you were asking about structure, I think it's often been then that I've gone, I need someone to help me, or this isn't efficient, or, you know, loads of people owe me money because I was invoicing everyone and no one was paying because I was out on the road all the time, you know, and those kind of things. It was like, this is a structural problem. It's, you know, it's not that I can't do it. I just need the right things in place. So, yeah, but now I get a lot more me time. I do yoga and I meditate every day without fail, usually twice. And I'm just more mindful. Mm. I'm like, you know what? If I get there 5 minutes late, it's all right.
It's fine.
They still like me. You know, it's okay. And just to really let myself off the hook a little bit rather than trying to be, I spend a lot of time trying to be perfect at everything all of the time and looking over my shoulder going, half the people will think I'm a crap mum because I'm working and yet I was picking up my kids and dropping them off every day. Half the people will think I'm not doing my job well enough because I'm distracted by my children. And after a while I just thought, you know, I don't care what anyone else thinks.
Yeah.
I can only tread my own path.
Yeah. There's an expression for that, but this is a G-rated show, so we better not say it.
I think I've probably said that to myself a few times about a few people.
Yep, absolutely. Let's shift a little. I would love to know how you're navigating the NDIS. And there could be two replies to this. There could be the mum family reply and there could be the business owner reply. How's that going?
Look, it is what it is. I mean, I feel like we've accepted it. I've had a great experience personally.
Oh, that's marvellous.
Fantastic. We have had what we needed.
Great.
But you know what? I'm really aware that I'm an educated in the field as well. And I am aware of that. I am aware that I know how to say I was falling in a hole. And other people may have said, well, maybe you shouldn't have been running a business. But they didn't. They said, what help do you need to dig yourself out of a hole and get your kids well supported? And I didn't mean putting in more from NDIS, really. It really gave me the NDIS gave me an opportunity personally when they came about my kids. And like I say, one has quite a lot of services and the other doesn't have any. But it gave me an opportunity to reflect on my overall life, because I was thinking, well, you know, am I doing too much out of home? And it's like, no, you're not. You're getting up, you're getting your kids ready every day. But then there's no little window before your first client, because I drop them down the road at school at 8:45. I'd have my first client in the paddock at 9. Like, those are stupid of me. So it gave me an opportunity to review, and it gave me an opportunity when they were saying, you know, would you like someone to come and help you in the mornings? No, not really. Actually, no. What I'd like to do is clear my head so that I can be more present for my children in the mornings. So I had a really good experience with it. And I like the way that they're doing some of the stuff around community participation, so that it doesn't all have to be therapy, that there are fun things that kids can go and. But what worries me is I knew in a way how to work with them to put in place the right kinds of things. And I'm very worried about people that don't have an advocate, who don't have a therapist yet because they have no money to get the therapist yet. So they've got nobody other than their GP to guide
get them in the door on the program. Yeah.
That worries me no end. And it really does. And anyone that rings up us and says we don't have NDIS and tells us a bit about their child and we think they may be eligible, we just say, come in, talk to us, we'll help you get started. Because that, I mean, that's good for business. They're going to come back with a package if we help them, but if nobody ever helps them, there'll never be any money to help them.
The getting really started piece,
and that's difficult.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say how it provided you with a reset as well, to sort of check in on your routines and your energy flow, and that sometimes it's not always the kid and the amount in the package that is going to make the shifts for the family.
No, oh, absolutely. Mm. And, you know, we do parent coaching as well. And if I'm leading it, my first session is all about how do you put the atmosphere of love back in your house.
Mm-hmm.
And your house has gone all toxic. It's really hard. And you haven't got what you wanted, and it's all very difficult, and you love your kids to bits, but God, do we have to live like this? You know, and how to get your love back into the house, and moving that energy around. It sounds really hippie, but we do a lot on that. And then talking to people about if they're going to do an NDIS review, this is the time to tell your planner, not that you want a part-time job, that you are getting a full-time job.
Correct. You don't seek permission.
That's right. You are getting a full-time job, and there is not much help that you need, but you do need this, you know, and how is that going to work? And you've exhausted the people that you know, and your mother's exhausted, and you know, you've had enough of the behaviour, and so you need the right kind of help. But I think for them, it can become a little bit about, you know, this is about me advocating for my child. My project is my child. And it's funny, when I had my eldest boy, I was reading back actually through a diary I was keeping at the time, and I wrote, the rest of my life's work can't be that this child is my project.
Mm.
And I wrote, I don't think that's what my family would like me to do. And it's really interesting, because I kind of didn't. I made making the right services for him and all like him my project, which is, I was in that position. I was going to say I'm lucky, but then again, maybe I put myself in that position by working hard at it. But do you know what I mean? It's like, it wasn't enough. And so sometimes I say to people, yes, this is your duty. Yes, you're the mother. Of course you want to advocate. Of course you want to get everything that they need. But that's not always having as much money as possible so you can run yourself ragged around as many appointments as you can fit in. You know, that's not always the quality of life for the family. And so to lead them through that to a point of, you are still a great mum. What are you doing with your guilt? You know, you're still a great
mum. More than my child.
Absolutely. And parents are on different bits of that journey, at different stages of that journey, and at different stages still with their grief. So, you know, that can take time. But yeah, to be able to have gone through the NDIS and to know you can use this as a reset, this whole awful workbook with all these terrible things you've got to care about your child.
Oh, the workbook.
Yeah, but it's not, you know, in a way, I think I used it as a self-coaching workbook. You know, what are my goals? What do I want to work on? What do I have time for?
If I had time to think of them, what would they be?
Yeah.
So how are you tracking with the NDIS from a business owner's perspective?
Look, okay. I mean, we get a lot of inquiries, and that's been difficult. And then making sure they're getting the right kinds of services that we're charging the right kind of fees. We are at the moment having a big philosophical discussion about whether we stay registered.
Oh, I was wondering if, okay.
It's expensive. It's so, so expensive, and it caps our fees at less than we would usually charge, which isn't the case for other practices that are, you know, only seeing people that are self-managed and plan managed. And so we have an ethical discussion about that a lot. We have a financial discussion about that a lot. I don't know where that's going to go. But what we do know is that we have a lot of expenses in our business, and we have to be able to manage that.
Keep the doors open.
And there comes a point where you go, I got people now, they're not far off wanting long service leave. You know, I need to have security for my future staff that are all going to need these rights of theirs, and absolutely right too. So you can't just keep letting the NDIS chop down what you can do and say, well, you won't be able to charge what you used to charge. And we're gonna now, you know, you're now going to have to pay to stay part of this, to be assessed, and we're going to make you pay us and jump through expensive hoops. It's just peculiar to me. It's absolutely a peculiar model to me. So I don't know what we'll decide about that. But, you know, look, the NDIS, it's our friend. We like working with it. We have certainly had lots of people that have come who have got kids over 8 who haven't had services for a long time, who didn't get the old, you know, funding for many, many years. Yeah. And one of the things it has done is we've changed our policy on older children. We used to kind of discharge them at, you know, we were a bit loose. It was either 18 or when they left school, and we were firm. We were a paediatric service. Now we've got kids coming to us and they're like 17, they're maybe in the last year of school. And they're like, we haven't had anything for 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like we talk about, oh, and obviously my patter was to start with was we've got young children. We know that early intervention is important. We the evidence suggests we need to work with them early. So we can't have young children on a waiting list while we're seeing much older children. And one very astute parent who advocates fantastically for her daughter said, but we didn't get that.
Yeah.
So now we've got this.
And there is no evidence. Perhaps emerging evidence for the teens and the young adults.
Yeah, so we're working on old evidence around, you know, we did used to say try and get in there under 3 or under 5 or under 8, but, you know, there isn't
very under 15 or under 20 or under 25 or under 29.
And who's measuring, you know, life skills and longer term, you know, mental well-being around
opportunity and opportunity cost as well.
Yeah, exactly.
I can imagine you guys would be exceptional with teens and young adults.
Yeah. Well, that's why we've set up our little, let's have a little, you know, home from home where you can make beds, put the laundry on, do the washing up and learn those skills.
Good old-fashioned things.
Yeah. Good old-fashioned OT. You know, you can grow it, you can take it in there, you can prepare it in the cooking group, you can cook it, you can eat it, and we can sit at the table and do some social skills. You know, so much goes on with that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So we've now said, look, we won't take referrals for adults that have left school already, but if we've got kids that we've been seeing for a year or two and they really are kicking goals with us, we'll now keep them on a bit longer.
The business will grow up with them.
Yes, and move them into more of a coaching model, which really we're trying to say to them, you know, look, we would like you to go and access an adult service, but we'll coach you into that and we'll let you know what you need to do and what you need to ask for there. Mm. And also we don't want to be so arrogant as to think we're offering something that's better than adult services, because I don't believe that's true. They provide fabulous services.
It's just different.
It's just different. Mm. And our kids with ID, our older kids with ID, all my therapists are saying, but we need to keep them a bit longer. And I'm kind of going, yeah, I get that. But let's not assume the other services can't do it, because they're doing it beautifully.
Yeah.
So we have to make sure we're not trying to keep them too, you know, because we like them.
And there's space in your customers' lives for the right amount of everything.
Yeah.
With the right conversations and the right roundtables and the right creative, non-defensive conversation around use of resources.
And I think that's what would be nice. I think everyone's still getting their heads around NDIS as separate practices. But I think what will emerge in the next couple of years is more of that who's in the geographical area? Why aren't we sitting down more?
Correct.
I think we used to sit down more. We used to sit down with each other more. And I think it's happening less and less. Everyone's trying to work it out. You know, people don't really know how to share clients as well as we used to, I don't think. So I would imagine that those kind of things where you're linking more, the especially around those older teens, what the adult services are doing, what the pediatric services are still providing, you know, that will, I think that will strengthen as we all get more used to NDIS.
Yeah.
But NDIS has taken everyone's, you know, energy and spirit for the last year or so down.
A little bit of a dint.
Because it's not rolled out all that long here either.
Yeah.
So we're still getting used to it. We're still only less than 2 years in.
Yeah. Gosh, of course, you do forget that.
Yeah.
What else is on the cards in the future for you guys?
Well, if you ask my practice manager, can we just leave everything just as it is?
We just finish something. We just start finishing.
I know. So basically everyone is like, nothing new. So what I am going to do, I am taking seriously training therapists who have horses and would like to include their horses in their practice. Even if they want to start with one or two clients a week, you have to get it right. You have to know what you're doing. Mm. And it's a growth area. It's very fashionable at the moment. But I get nervous that lots of people will just start doing it and they won't protect themselves, let alone protect the horse and the clients. So I would really like to get in that space more. I'm drafting a book at the moment which is going to help people to do that. And I've got a vet that's going to write a chapter so they'll know what they're doing. I've got a horse behaviourist that's going to help. So I'm getting together the people that have helped me. And when that's finished, then that will be a good resource for people to be able to look at and go, okay, well, that's interesting. What kind of clinic interventions, evidence-based practice, are you taking to the paddock? Because at the end of the day, we're still evidence-based practice. You know, so that will happen, and then later in the year also training some courses to some PD, and I'm hoping, I have talked to OT Australia and I'm really hoping they've said that they'll be part of that, and I'm really hoping that we do that together, because I think it's helpful for an emerging area of practice to be done properly. So that's what will keep me busy, and it also gives me a really good excuse to have a day a week that's horse training. That's what I really want to do with my time.
A day a week in your gumboots, in your blunnies.
Surely I can justify it now. In the name of my own research. You know, well, I need to know exactly what my horses are going to do if I do this one.
I'll just pop out and ask them.
Yeah. But, you know, someone did actually write a book that the horse had told her to write, and it's actually a really interesting book.
Wow.
It's all the horse's voice. Yeah. It's out there. Yeah, so, but no, I won't be doing that. It will be written by, you know, a registered OT.
Some humans.
Yeah.
Anything else on the cards for 2020?
No, I think for me, stepping away from the clients a bit more, maybe not longer term. I'm hoping to set up more groups and more equine therapy, but I feel like I need to just go within a little bit, get some of the stuff I need to do in place, and then kind of, you know, launch maybe some new groups and some new ways of working, and that's what I would like to focus on. But obviously I need to keep supporting the, you know, barefoot therapists and support my staff there. And so for me it's going to be a bit of a juggle of, okay, where do I make space and what do I want to do? And you know what, if I'm honest, a bit more of what do I want to put in that space. And if I want to put in that space trotting around in the paddock for half a day, then this year I'm going to.
Love it. How about you have the last word for other allied health business owners out there? What would you like them to think about?
Oh, I would just like them to sit in meditation for a few minutes and just let the intuition take over a little bit. Just be guided. I know it sounds out there, but sometimes we get so very easy to get your head buried in your profit and loss. And it's very easy to be setting goals that you think are achievable and you think everyone else will like. But sometimes there is nothing nicer than saying, you know what, I always wanted to do this and maybe I can actually bring this into my practice. And some of those self-coaching intuitive things that aren't that, you know, am I doing this or something different? That am I doing this but doing it a little bit differently? Mm-hmm. Can I bring my passion in? And I think most of the time, yeah, you can.
Oh, absolutely love it. Thank you so much for our conversation. I'm going to drop in one time when I'm heading up to buy some cherries and strawberries, so I'll give you a little text on the way.
Yes, do. Put the kettle on.
Yeah, absolutely love it. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you, Kathy.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Private Practice Made Perfect podcast. For show notes and other resources, please visit practicemadeperfectpodcast.com. While you are there, you can subscribe for future episodes and continue your business adventure with me. And please be sure to share this and other episodes with your friends and colleagues.